From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Tuesday witnessed the most serious rocket barrage from Gaza into southern Israel in 4 years, prompting an Israeli airstrike and following weeks of border protests. The Israeli military said dozens of rockets and mortar bombs were fired, many down by the Iron Dome aerial defense system. At least 3 Israeli soldiers were wounded. Hamas member Ismail Radwan described the escalation as dangerous, saying the Zionist occupation bears complete responsibility. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his government views such attacks with the utmost gravity and blamed Hamas and Islamic Jihad. Israeli aircraft were said to have hit more than 50 militant targets in Gaza, including a cross-border tunnel under construction. Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Conricus is an Israeli military spokesman.
Hamas is responsible, and we know that Hamas has the ability to control the level of violence. Violence will be met with the appropriate response, and quiet will be met with the appropriate response.
The armed wings of Hamas and Islamic Jihad claim responsibility for the barrage, saying it was in response to the killing of more than 100 Palestinians in border protests since March. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres appealed for more predictable financial backing for the anti-terror Sahel force during a tour of Mali. The 5,000-person force made up from troops from Mali, Niger, Chad, Burkina Faso, and Mauritania. The UN chief is also in Mali to support the UN peacekeeping mission. Ethiopia Tuesday released Ander Gachu Tsige, top member of an armed opposition group, the dual Ethiopian-British citizen among hundreds of pardoned last week under new Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo expected to meet senior North Korean leader Kim Jong-chol Wednesday in New York ahead of next month's planned U.S.-North Korea summit. President Donald Trump in a tweet said the meeting is a solid response to his letter last week canceling a June 12 summit over what he called the North's open hostility. The White House said preparations for the meeting are now well underway. U.S. teams are busy in Singapore and at the Korean Truce Village at Panmunjom. Heather Nauert is a State Department spokesperson.
I'm not going to presume to know why the North Koreans and the United States started having conversations again. It's not my place to do so. I can just tell you now that we are looking forward to having these meetings, and I think we've seen a tremendous amount of progress over the past few days alone.
A U.S. official said the talks are aimed at determining whether Pyongyang is serious about getting rid of its nuclear weapons. Rival Libyan factions agreed in principle Tuesday at a Paris conference to open the way to UN-backed national elections by December 10th.
C'est la première fois que sous ce format-là,
host French President Emmanuel Macron hailed the Libyan leaders for accepting to work together under a joint declaration. However, no document was signed. Libya has been in chaos since the fall of dictator Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. The U.S. in an annual report declared Tuesday that despite some progress, religious freedom remains under assault around the world. Sam Brownback is the ambassador at large for international religious freedom.
Two of the main objectives, goals of the Trump administration are less terrorism and more economic growth. With religious freedom, you get both. Religious freedom helps an economy to grow, and it produces less terrorism. And this is now in the academic data. On top of the basic issue that is a fundamental human right. It's in the UN Declaration of Human Rights. It's in our First Amendment. It's in documents supporting human rights around the world.
The U.S. is expected to convene its first ministerial meeting in July to promote religious freedom as a universal human right. U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis Tuesday said the U.S. would keep confronting China through freedom of navigation missions over its territorial claims in the South China Sea.
We'll continue that. There had been a promise in 2015 by the President Xi in the Rose Garden, the White House meeting, where he stated they would not be militarizing the Spratly Islands. We have seen in the last month they have done exactly that.
Beijing has voiced its strong dissatisfaction after 2 U.S. warships sailed by an island in the disputed Paracel chain. A prison inmate on leave ambushed 2 Belgian policewomen Tuesday in Liege, Belgium, killing both with their guns. He also killed a nearby civilian before being killed in a shootout with police. Belgium has been on high alert for terrorism because of recent attacks.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barté in Washington. Today is Wednesday, May 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. There are reports Al-Shabaab militants have beheaded at least 10 people in Mozambique.
This is a worrying, an increase of worrying from government authorities in Mozambique, but all over Southern Africa due to the increase of alleged terrorism attacks.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaiva. Intracontinental migration can be economic boom for Africa. The East African Court of Justice will hear an appeal on the 2015 Burundian presidential election. And Zimbabwe's president will soon announce the date for this year's presidential election, but an opposition leader says conditions are not conducive to hold the elections.
I think all Democrats, whether in politics or outside politics, are concerned that the conditions do not exist yet in Zimbabwe for free, credible and fair elections.
Simba Makoni is a former Zimbabwe finance minister and leader of the Mavambo Kusili Dawn Party. A Nigerian university remains open in defiance of Boko Haram, and Kenyan farmers change their crops to adapt to climate change. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. There are reports alleged Al-Shabaab terrorists have beheaded at least 10 people in the Cabo Delgado province of Mozambique, including some children. According to reports, the region is a center of mining and oil exploration, and Al-Shabaab is said to be making millions of dollars from selling timber and diamonds. Mozambican police were not available to comment on the alleged attack. Radio Mozambique was quoted as saying unknown persons killed at least 10 people by decapitation in recent days. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaiva says attacks by Islamists have been an issue of concern to authorities since last year.
I just confirmed with some fellows in Mozambique, and this is a worrying, an increase of worrying from government authorities in Mozambique, but all over Southern Africa due to the increase of alleged terrorism attacks. In fact, 10 people were beheaded, amongst them two children and more, another four people were beheaded. But this is not the first time. I must remember last October 2017 was the first attack of alleged jihadists in the northern province of Cabo Delgado. At that time, this is just killing two officers and 14 people.
Mario, this is kind of, I would say, shocking to me to say that Al-Shabaab is in Mozambique. What is Al-Shabaab doing in Mozambique of all places? One report say that probably they are involved in some logging. What do you know about that?
Yes, it's not about the local business. You know that the village of Palma, it's a place where there are international business, not only on timber, but not far from Palma. Eni, the old giant from Italy, is supposed to work in there in terms of investments in gas. Apart from that, I must underline that there are strong suspicions that some local people, which are not well paid, are supposed to be recruited from Al-Shabaab members. So now it's becoming a quite serious problem in the north of Mozambique at the Cabo Delgado province.
Information earlier this month said that police were offering at least 1 million shilling as a bounty on one Francis Macharia Karushi. He is suspected to be an illegal documents facilitator who has been helping Al-Shabaab terrorists fraudulently acquire Kenyan identity cards. What does that mean?
In my point of view, this means there is some of local involvement, either from some kind of illicit business on the other hand, and former people from police and former army retired people. So we can stay at one village and do this kind of things without some local contact. And this is becoming quite serious.
Mario, before I let you go, I'd like to ask you about President Dos Santos, the former president of Angola. Did he say that now he is leaving the ruling party, the MPLA?
Yes. So last Friday, at least, the former president Dos Santos assumed that finally he will leave the president of the ruling party, MPLA. They will hold the party congress in the next 70th of September. And the main issue will be the change of the guard from Dos Santos' leadership to João Lourenço. So everybody is waiting on what the final September may be. This is João Lourenço could improve the reforms agenda or something like that.
Mario, thank you very much again. Always nice to have you on Daybreak Africa. Thank you.
Thank you, James.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpava speaking with us from the capital, Luanda. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa may be on the verge of announcing the much-awaited date of this year's presidential election. This comes after the president on Monday signed the Electoral Amendment Act, according to the Zimbabwe News Network. Also, voter registration is expected to conclude this week. In other development, the European Union has announced it will deploy observers to Zimbabwe's general election, the first time in 16 years. But Simba Makoni, a former Zimbabwe finance minister and leader of the Mavambo Kusuili Dawn Party, says conditions are not conducive to hold this year's election.
I think all Democrats, whether in politics or outside politics, are concerned that the conditions do not exist yet in Zimbabwe for free, credible and fair elections. All the issues that concerned us before Robert Mugabe was ousted still exist. Media are not accessible to the opposition, particularly the state media. There is still a lot of intimidation and even violence, particularly against opposition activists and defenders of human rights. There is abuse and misuse of state resources to the benefit of the ruling political party. The economy is still in such dire straits that resourcing campaigns other than those who can raid state coffers is not very easy. The Electoral Commission does not bring confidence that it can manage the elections efficiently and in a neutral manner. So all the issues that concerned Democrats in Zimbabwe before the so-called new dispensation still exist.
Let me say that President Mnangagwa earlier this year promised that he is going to make sure that these elections are going to be free and fair.
James, Mnangagwa is making a lot of promises. They are empty, they are hollow promises. The key determinant is what is he doing to bring those promises to effect? Absolutely nothing.
What would you like for him to do to ensure that the elections are going to be free and fair?
Let me just summarize. The environment of fear and intimidation persists today. We saw it even within ZANU-PF during their primaries, that they were intimidating each other. They were even violently dealing with opponents, what more with opposition activists. I mentioned the media landscape. You watch the BC News, it's still Mnangagwa, Auxilia, ED, ZANU-PF, two-thirds of the time. There is no meaningful airing of opposition views and positions. The Electoral Commission remains very firmly captured by ZANU-PF to the extent that simple things like engaging opposition and defenders of human rights to be sure that the voters' roll is clean, that voters are confirmed to be on the roll, that the data that contains the voters' roll is secure under circumstances that everybody is satisfied. All those issues are not attended to.
Mr. Makoni, I ask you whether you are not standing for president in this particular election and you have a coalition that has fielded a candidate. Why can't you, the opposition parties in Zimbabwe, form one coalition to go against the establishment?
James, I am embarrassed but honest enough to acknowledge that that is one of our greatest weaknesses. I contested only once to be president of Zimbabwe. The second time round, I supported Morgan Tsvangirai because I believe very strongly that all those people who genuinely want change in Zimbabwe need to work together. Unfortunately, that has eluded us for all these years, but some of us continue working for unity among the genuine Democrats of Zimbabwe. Even today, we are working for unity among those who want to gain real change for our country and its people.
Simba Makoni is a former Zimbabwe finance minister and leader of the Mavambo Kusili Dawn Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Harare. Today is Wednesday, May 30th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Botti in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. The East African Court of Justice has agreed to hear an appeal brought by the East Africa Civil Society Organization about the 2015 Burundi presidential election. The court is charged with resolving disputes involving member states of the East African community. In 2015, the regional court abstained from ruling on the eligibility of President Pierre Nkurunziza to run for another term in office. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura.
In April 2015, Burundi's ruling party, the FDD party, publicly announced President Pierre Nkurunziza as its candidate for the then presidential elections. The move sparked violence and led to more than 1,000 people losing their lives. Opposition members argued that the incumbent president had already served two terms in the office since taking over in 2005. However, supporters of the ruling party said that the first term of 5 years could not count since he wasn't elected directly by the people, but rather elected by the parliament. Nestor Kayobera is a lawyer of Burundian government.
And the government of Burundi has not yet been notified of their judgment. And the Republic of Burundi is the only partner state of the East African community which has not yet lost a single case in that court. So we are confident that it is not that case which we lose. But as you know, we have won in the first instance division, which is the lower court of the East African Court of Justice.
According to the Article 96 of the Burundian Constitution, the President of the Republic is elected by the universal suffrage for a term of 5 years, renewable once. Since the incumbent president was elected in 2005 by the parliament, ruling party supporters believe that it was a transitional government and he was only elected by Burundians in 2010 and 2015. Martha Makenge is the chief executive officer of the East African Civil Society Organization Forum. It is an umbrella body of non-government organizations in the region that filed the case against Burundi government.
We feel like we still have a right to appeal, so that we are, that way we are appealed, and that way we are waiting for the hearing for the next court ruling. On the same that the court should also give us their judgment on the interpretation of the law in terms of the treaty itself when it comes to decisions given by the national court against the regional court.
The 2005 Burundi Constitution and the 2000 Arusha Agreement restored peace and stability after decades of civil war between Hutu and the Tutsi ethnic groups. Burundian government lawyer Nestor Kayobera is optimistic that Burundi will still come out victorious.
A case of 2015 related to elections, we are ready to lose it in 2018 or 2019. As we have been winning other cases, even this one we win it, and we are confident.
This month, Burundians voted to amend the constitution and scrapping presidential term limits. Critics say the amendment is intended to maintain President Pierre Nkurunziza in power until 2034. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
A high-level panel on migration says sub-regional migration on the continent is brisk and having a beneficial impact on African economies. During a two-day meeting in Geneva, the panel has been exploring ways to maximize these benefits by making migration safe, orderly, and regular. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The UN Migration Agency reports 1 billion people are currently on the move, yet media reports of migration crises, such as those in the Mediterranean Sea and along the border between the United States and Latin America, tend to paint a negative image of this process. Rarely do they discuss the many contributions made by migrants to their adoptive societies. Former Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is chair of the high-level panel on migration. She says it is time to end this misperception of migrants and to demystify migration on the African continent. Sirleaf says the human tragedy unfolding in the Mediterranean Sea makes it seem that hordes of migrants are fleeing Africa. She tells VOA, though the number of Africans crossing over is relatively small.
But because they face such hardships, because many times their rights are infringed upon, these get the sensational reports. And then it forms this perception that a majority of Africans are trying to leave the continent to seek opportunities. But the reality is really far from the perception.
Sirleaf says data show within the continent, 70% of the overall migration is intra-African, that is, Africans moving from one African country to another. Former Liberian President Sirleaf says the free movement of goods and services and development strategies require the free movement of people across national boundaries. She says this will enable African countries to explore opportunities and achieve economic transformation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thousands of students continue to attend the University of Maiduguri in northeastern Nigeria, despite at least a dozen attacks by the Boko Haram insurgency since the start of last year. Chika Odua reports from Maiduguri on how the university has been able to stay open and, some would say, even thrive amidst the constant danger.
At the University of Maiduguri's radio station, DJs not only have to play music, they also try to keep students calm.
We make it a priority to do that, to keep them positive. Of course, to try and stay relaxed, focus on their studies.
That's because the university of 20,000 students is in the city where the terrorist group Boko Haram was formed and where it continues to launch deadly attacks. Throughout Boko Haram's 9-year war against the Nigerian government, the university was never targeted until January 2017. Tasiu Hassan remembers that very first attack.
I was on campus, actually. On that very day, even me too, I have examination, but the university management had to cancel all the examination. I found myself in a very, very terrible situation, in such a way that I have even started thinking of going back home.
But he stayed, like many of his classmates. Since then, the university has been hit at least 12 times, university officials told VOA. Suicide bombers have detonated explosives at the school on separate incidents. About a dozen members of the geology department were kidnapped in June. The university is the most prestigious and largest public educational institution in northeastern Nigeria. The students are defying Boko Haram's message, which denounces Western education as sinful. Today, students are taking their final exams. The university has never closed for a single day throughout Boko Haram's insurgency.
To show how resilient we are, to show how much sacrifice we are making, and that is the true reflection of the Maiduguri spirit. We are here because we have a responsibility to keep the system going. Somebody has to be around to do the job, no matter how bad the situation is.
Last year, authorities dug a 27-kilometer-long trench around the university's eastern perimeter, which faces Cameroon, where many Boko Haram insurgents operate. The trench is designed to slow down Boko Haram fighters who often invade cities on motorcycle. Every day, sniffer dogs carry out inspections. They're looking out for bomb chemicals and weapons. No other public Nigerian university in the region has this level of security. It's why Esther Clement continues to go to school here.
Even though there's insurgency, we are secured. As you can see, even before you come to the gate of the, to the gate one, at the gate of the hostel, there are securities. Even when there is bomb blast, they call us to calm us down. They secure the whole hostels. We don't go out.
Despite the obvious risk, the student population is growing. And current students say the school is actually getting stronger in the fight against Boko Haram. Chika Odua, For VOA News, Maiduguri, Nigeria.
Kenyan farmers are changing their crops to adapt to climate change and droughts. With the support of the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, more Kenyan farmers are switching from corn to sorghum and seeing better results in terms of nutrition and income. Barack Okoba, FAO project manager in Kenya, spoke with Ricky Stryak about the benefits of sorghum.
Most farmers are moving from growing of corn to sorghum, and this is only for the farmers who are in semi-arid areas, not across the whole country. And they are doing this because it is drought tolerant. That is, sorghum is drought tolerant. But besides that, it is fetching better money because they are focusing on sorghum that can be used by the breweries for making beer.
Besides being drought resistant, has this had any other effect on the local population in terms of food availability? Is sorghum more nutrient rich as well?
Yeah, it is. Definitely sorghum has better nutrition than maize. Besides being drought tolerant, the nutrition is good. It can be stored longer than maize. Farmers can mix it. Sometimes they make other products out of the sorghum. For example, for baking their local cake, they can mix it with other beverages and it makes a more nutritious meal for them. So the switching to maize, you know, as you know, maize requires a lot of input in terms of nutrients, especially in the semi-arid areas where the rainfall is very low. And for that reason, they prefer to have sorghum because of the two or three reasons I've given in terms of drought tolerance, higher nutrition.
And another interesting thing, I think, is that sorghum is actually, of course, native to this area of East Africa, while corn is not. How did corn get there in the first place?
I think, as you know, it's corn, it is sources Southern America. It was introduced here by the British during the colonization, and it has become almost the food. In fact, when you ask most Kenyans, they will tell you food is corn, you know, or maize flour. But because of increasing competition for that and the climate change, the same grain or crop cannot grow everywhere. Farmers are now changing to diversify to other crops.
And is there any resistance to changing the diet?
Of course, if you can only resist if you have alternatives. But in the face of food scarcity, increasing population, people are looking for alternatives. And with education, an organization like FAO have put in effort to train farmers on food diversity, making sure they meet their nutrition security. Farmers are changing. And especially the urban population is changing drastically.
That was Barack Okoba, project manager with the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, who was speaking to Ricky Stryak from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. There are reports alleged Al-Shabaab terrorists have beheaded at least 10 people in the Cabo Delgado province of Mozambique, including some children. And that's it for this Wednesday, May 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Butte. Have a good day, Africa.
It's the weekend, and whatever you're doing, you could use a little extra love. Music love, that is. Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa, and I've got the perfect weekend show for you. I'm the king of the Kuntu, and the loving the way I do this uncle. First, a 30-minute playlist of the continent's best music. Then, a live studio interview and music performance by Leni Stern Trio. Think award-winning female electric guitar player falls in love with West African griot music. Lots of love coming to you this weekend. Don't don't miss it on Music Time in Africa, Sunday and the following Saturday at 15 and 2000 UTC. Yeah!